Hi, this is Kendall Boyson, professional life and recovery coach, and you're listening to Encouragementology, the practice of instilling hope. Hi there. Thanks for joining me. On this show, we are exploring the impact your mindset has on hope and your future as we lean into producing empowering thoughts. It's time to stop the hamster wheel of thinking for an important check-in. It's no secret that our minds are incredibly active, even when we're sleeping. According to cognitive neuroscientists, we are conscious of only about 5% of our cognitive activity. So most of our decisions, actions, emotions, and behavior depends on the 95% of the brain activity that goes beyond our conscious awareness. It's time to be intentional and grab a little more of that unconscious market share. We can move in the right direction by shifting our thinking patterns, interrupt negative self-talk, and be willing to embrace the unknown with possibility and hope. If you're in a rut and think tomorrow holds no promise but to be a repeat of today, then it will. Henry Ford said, "If you think you can, or if you think you can't, either way, you're right." So much of your attitude determines success or failure. I remember leading a support group one night and a participant said, "You can't just be happy. It doesn't work that way." I'm not sure whether that statement is right or wrong, and I wasn't insinuating that one could flip a switch, but I was encouraging them to choose to move in that direction. And in that, you have a choice. Understanding the power you possess to alter your thinking and shift your perspective can lead to a future where you are the architect of your own success and fulfillment. To kick us off, Dr. Dan J. Tomasello shares the thinking habits of highly hopeful people found at psychologytoday.com. In the preamble to its constitution, the World Health Organization identifies this core principle: health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Yet 80% of people with depression relapse. With all of the medicines, psychotherapies, vitamins, alternative therapies, and things you've heard about, like yoga and exercise, despite everything we've thrown at it, 80% of people who get depressed again. If we were a business that made flashlights and 80% of them failed to light up, we wouldn't be in business very long, would we? This idea that the absence of disease or infirmity is not the truth only or the full criteria for health has been the foundational shift in positive psychology over the last 20 years. Science has moved from looking at what's wrong to focusing on what's strong. By focusing on the 20%, we learn how the strong survive and thrive. For too long, psychology has looked at the 80%, trying to make people not depressed. But not being depressed isn't the same as being happy. What are the 20% doing? More importantly, can we learn how to do it too? Dr. Tomasello said this was the subject of my research in writing Learned Hopefulness, The Power of Positivity to Overcome Depression. This new approach helps empower people to make changes by assisting them to experience more positive emotions while learning to reduce the negative ones simultaneously. Increasing well-being through positivity might seem like an ineffective way of reducing negativity, yet studies repeatedly show that it will be the most effective method worldwide. Focusing on increasing our positive emotions while using our strengths is emerging as the most successful and efficient tool to reduce our experience of stress, worry, and anxiety. This is a radically different approach to well-being than those where symptom reduction is only half the job and specific interventions to improve positivity are the other half. We have learned that decreasing negativity without increasing positivity is a losing battle. We know this because negative and positive thoughts are typically unbalanced when under stress and worry. Imagine those negative thoughts are like pebbles, and positive thoughts are like feathers. We have survived as a species because we've learned how to worry. Scientists call this the negativity bias. We are drawn to fear of what might hurt us in some way. Over time, we have emphasized worry, and positive emotions have become little more than mere frivolities. We don't linger on them. Typically, we go back to worrying about the next thing on our list. The question is, can the feathers ever balance out the scale? Can they tip it in the direction of positivity? The short answer is yes, but initially you'll need a lot of feathers. Medicine and traditional therapy approaches knocked the negative thoughts off the seesaw and kept the pebbles from piling on, but they do nothing to add to the feathers. We might indeed come back into balance for a while, but if we don't add feathers to the other side, if we don't add positive emotions into the equation by using our strengths, even a grain of sand will send the balance in the other direction of anxiety. We relapse because there isn't anything positive being added to the feather side. This is to say that positive psychology can offer the other half of the equation. Designed to work with medical and traditional therapeutic approaches, adding positivity into our life is an opportunity to add the findings of positive psychology to the toolbox. When pebbles get tossed on our scale, it's essential to become more empowered to remove them and learn how to add more positivity. This approach is very dynamic because it keeps the pebbles from accumulating while looking for and learning how to gather more feathers. Once you know how to balance the scale by removing negative thoughts, you can keep them at bay by adding more positivity. In other words, this approach teaches you how to hope. That was the secret behind the 20% that didn't relapse. They continually added positive emotions and experiences to their life to counterbalance the negative. By learning to regularly remove the thoughts, feelings, behaviors, and beliefs that were getting them depressed and adding those that would increase positivity, they learned how to remain hopeful. As it turns out, people who are more hopeful see the world in a different way. In studying what makes people have high hope or low hope, I've found that the high hope people have 7 thinking habits about how they are going to perceive the world. Hope is the only positive emotion that requires activation of negativity or uncertainty. Without bleakness, the spark for hope isn't ignited. We have no need for hope without sorrow. Low hope people fail to realize that the negativity or uncertainty is a call to action, one that can serve to change their perception about a situation. Their perception of the circumstance is fixed, causing them to repeatedly focus on the negative, not challenging themselves and then isolating. In contrast, high hope people know that hope is the regulation of perception toward believing in control of the future. They believe a positive future outcome is possible, combined with a desire for that outcome. They search out ways to cultivate positive feelings while entertaining possibilities. They cherish relationships and will seek support in achieving their goals. High hope people stand ready for life's challenges, and the payoff comes from research that shows they will live longer, healthier, and happier lives. If you want to begin living more like a high hope person, start by picking one of the 7 decisions that you'd like to work on. Then challenge yourself to look for the possibilities within these situations that you once thought of as fixed or unchangeable. Ask yourself questions that help you find and focus on what can happen rather than what can't. If you don't have a goal to challenge yourself to strive for, you might want to set one and work toward it this week. Number one, high hope people have a positive outlook. Number two, high hope people are persistent. Number three, high hope people set goals and work toward them. Number four, high hope people are those who surround themselves with positive people. Number five, high hope people focus on the present. Number six, high hope people are confident. And number seven, high hope people are self-reflective. Now, I have always been a pretty positive person. I don't sit with sadness long. I let things just roll off my back. And I've said this before, it's primarily because I don't like to be in a bad mood. Yes, a good cry, a good crawl under the covers is great, but I'm quick to move into problem-solving mode. Now, that doesn't mean I don't enjoy a good pity party, but I do rebound quickly. I recognize that that's not the same for everyone. And the reason I was inspired by this topic was I had a recent call with someone who didn't have any hope. Imagine the opposite side of a hopeful coin. No hope. I was turned on to this person because I'm an encourager, and it was told to me that this person might need a little encouragement. So I did reach out. Now, I've heard a lot of stories in my life, and I've heard a lot of tragedy, just tragedy that would break your heart. But I've never talked to anyone who doesn't have any hope. It was really bizarre to me. And if you're an encourager, you're a person that likes to make people feel good and you've got a little song and dance for that, but you're talking to someone who's truly depressed and doesn't see any hope, it is very difficult to turn that around. Everything that you say, everything that you suggest is hit with a brick wall. I just let this person talk. And it wasn't one of those, let me let you talk until I can find a moment to jump in and tell you that you're wrong and how you can turn it around. Instead, I just let this person be heard. I just listened, empathetically listened to understand. But I am a Christian, and one thing I do believe in is prayer. So I told this person, whether they were a believer or not, that I felt like praying for an openness and willingness to see things differently was exactly what they needed. I also reminded them, if you think tomorrow is going to be exactly like today, and you have no hope that there's any chance that it will be different, then it won't. If you don't know, if you're not 100% sure, then you do have hope, and that's one tiny little thing you can build on. Without this one thing, you have no foundation, no cornerstone. A lot of times when I talk about gratitude, I talk about finding something the size of a baby's breath to start building your bouquet of gratitude. There's plenty of days that we don't feel grateful, that we are just stuck in our own problems, in our own mind. Another way to change that thinking or to start moving again, it's not a light switch, but moving in that direction, is pour into someone else and then catch the overflow in your cup. Recent research suggests our well-being can benefit from practicing pro-social behavior. By helping others regulate their emotions, helps us regulate our own emotions, decreases symptoms of depression, and ultimately improves our emotional well-being. I had a gentleman in one of my groups, we'll call him Ray. And Ray came in and said, you know, I'm just not feeling it today. I don't really want to share. I'm kind of grumpy, not in a great mood. I said, that's fine, Ray. You just listen and just be there for others. And as everyone took a time sharing, I saw Ray pouring into them. If the other person was a little bit negative, Ray would say, but hey, did you look at it this way? Or hey, don't forget, you could do this. And Ray kept pouring into each person in this circle. And by the time we got back around, Ray was in a totally great mood. It works. If you don't feel it, pour into someone else and see what happens. Maya Shrinkit shares the science of hope, more than wishful thinking, found on the ASU website. Hoping to win the lottery? I know so many people that are. That would actually be a wish you have. Hoping to have a good day today? That's being optimistic. According to social science researchers in Arizona State University's Center for the Advanced Study and Practice of Hope, having hope is harder work than we may think. They are unpacking the ways in which different populations conceive of hope and exploring how having higher hopes can improve our health and well-being. In psychology, hope is a cognitive practice that involves the intentional act of setting goals and working towards them with purpose. Hopeful people are able to set goals, identify ways to reach their goals, and feel as though they can do the work to achieve those goals. This comes from Crystal Bryce, Associate Director of Research in the Hope Center and Clinical Assistant Professor in the T. Denny Stanford School of Social and Family Dynamics. John Parsi, Executive Director of the Hope Center, thinks about using hope like driving from ASU's Temple campus to the downtown Phoenix campus. If there's an accident on the I-10 or construction on the Broadway curve, I have to work around that to get to my destination. I can't just stop in the middle of the highway and give up. I have to navigate through the traffic using hope theory and ultimately take agency to literally steer my actions. Parsi emphasizes that it's important to know the difference between hope and blind optimism. Hope is an active process. Dreams and optimism are just belief structures. When you're an optimistic person, you believe things in the world will turn out just fine no matter what happens. Parsi says that because optimism doesn't require a person to do anything, it can be a form of toxic positivity. But from the working scientific definition of hope, hope can only do good for a person. Hopeful people cannot just wish things into existence. Hope requires a person to take responsibility for their wants and desires and take action in working towards them. Optimistic people see the glass as half full, but hopeful people ask how they can fill the glass full. One of the center's ongoing projects is exploring what hope looks like in populations of ASU first-year students. Research has shown that more hopeful students are better off in terms of their health and ability to tackle future challenges. Students that have more hope do better in school. They've developed more social and emotional skills and foster stronger connections with their peers. The strategy of hope is fairly robust in its real-world impact. This isn't a squishy science. Increased hope has been shown to be more effective than many mental health interventions in youth populations. Even as experts in this field, we get surprised time and time again by the impact and results these hope interventions have on the populations they're implemented in. The team places special emphasis on hope research in college students because positive psychology in the college experience is generally understudied. If you look at most studies around college students, historically, it's really negative. Researchers often look at drinking, drug use, suicide, and pregnancy, all of these negatively associated outcomes. Part of our center's objective is to show that this is a great time in young people's lives. This is really a time where people can change the course of their lives if they want to. The team's data shows that first-year students with high hopes in their first semester of college were more likely to enroll in a second year than students with low hope. Increased hope in these students is also associated with pro-social behavior, better civic attitudes, and increased community engagement in college. In the next stage of this study, the team wants to see how student levels of hope affect their well-being and social-emotional skills. The data has shown that the first year of college is a really great intervention point. We could really target first semester students and teach them how to cultivate their hope. Some of them might not even know that hope is teachable. Many of the Hope Center's other research projects revolve around the Kids at Hope, an affiliated nonprofit committed to working with youth-serving organizations to cultivate a culture of hope in community settings. The partnership allows researchers in the center to work with practitioners in the community and translate research into real-world impact. The hope research field is already fairly small, said Parsi, who also serves as president of Kids at Hope. In Michigan's Macomb County, the ASU team has been working with the state's juvenile justice system to investigate how probation officers, educators, and administrators within the incarceration community view and promote hope in youth on probation. Kids at Hope and the Hope Center team have also partnered with the Saddle Mountain Unified School District in Arizona to see how hope practice curriculum can be integrated into schooling and how it impacts student relationships, engagement, and achievement. Our lives are holistic. We're more than our work and more than our families, so we must set goals in all areas of our lives. This often starts with small goal setting and breaking down big goals into smaller, more reachable interim goals. In their Hope curriculum, Kids at Hope teaches practitioners three universal truths. Every child, no exception, is capable of success. Connection between adults and youth is meaningful and impactful. Goal setting happens in many areas, including education and career, home and family, community and service, and hobbies and recreation. Everyone in these communities sees the glimmers of hope and understands how important it is to the success of their youth, but they're not quite sure how to increase hope or support that kind of culture. That's where we come in with our research on socialization to further their goals as organizations. They offer some tips on how to get your hopes up in ways that benefit you and your community. Number one, take small steps for long-term success. Think about your goals for just today and make a list of actions that you need to do to accomplish those goals. Then envision your larger, long-term goals and see how your actions today will help you achieve those bigger, broader goals you have for yourself. Number two, check in with yourself. If you aren't excited and enthusiastic about taking the next step in reaching your goals, odds are your goals need to be adjusted. Ask yourself if you're excited about the future ahead of you and if your actions leading you there have energy behind them. Number three, consider context. The team encourages people to consider the cultural context they live in when evaluating how hopeful they are. Some of the center's research revolves around how different ethnic populations like Hispanic and Latino communities view and practice hope. We do see something similar in hope in every culture. Part of that is because the human condition is designed to look forward. The conception of hope looks different in religious communities, though the outcomes are still overwhelmingly positive. Hope is also a big positive impact in medical patient communities. Number four, remember that hope takes practice. Even the researchers studying hope admit that they don't always practice what they preach to others. Hope is really hard. There are times where I don't have as much hope as I want to. When I'm teaching a class or applying for grants, I constantly find myself trying to find those small steps to get the larger goals I want to fulfill at the moment. We have to consistently remind ourselves of this, though we are entrenched in it all the time, said the researchers. Number five, foster a culture of hope. The researchers at ASU Center for the Advanced Study and Practice of Hope emphasize that hope thrives within communities that support and uplift one another. As a hope researcher and community member, Parsi feels responsible to be a part of the success and failures of all the people in the communities he belongs to. It's my responsibility not to pull the ladder up behind me, but instead to let the hardships I went through inform the idea that success of our children belongs to all of us. I love their research, and getting it out in the hands of more people will impact so many more of our children, which in turn will impact our whole world. I speak life. It may be that simple. We all have dreams and aspirations. We even have daydreams where we imagine ourselves doing this or that. You know, a good daydream where you can see yourself, whether it's a relaxation kind of thing, or you see yourself really accomplishing a goal, maybe already being there. That is the power of visualization. But don't just see it, speak it. Today will be a great day. I have the opportunity to impact so many people in my lives. I'm going to look for those people. I'm going to go out, make an intentional connection with those around me, and I'm going to speak life to them as well. How many times do you verbalize it over your life? Instead of letting your negative thinking take over and then spill out of your mouth, take control of that. In the morning, walk around your house talking about, "This cup of coffee is going to be great today. I can't wait to meet my first client. I know that when someone needs me, I'm going to be right there with a smile and positivity." You can pump yourself up and speak life. Catch yourself predicting the unknown. Have you ever heard, when you get older, your eyesight goes? Have you heard things like, "Everyone has to struggle. That's just a part of life." Or, "Marriage is supposed to be the hardest job you've ever had." Or even, "When you retire, you'll have tons of free time." Who told you this? Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever thought about adopting those ideas? Early on may dictate how your life goes. Why do you accept this as your truth? Make up your mind today. It will be different, whether it turns out to be the same or not. Commit to seeing opportunities instead of roadblocks. And give yourself a pep talk. "Hey, you and I are in this together. Let's go get it." We can have energy, we can have health, and we can have success. Don't let others dictate our outcomes for us. Joan Ridsdell at the Family Center gives us 10 common negative thinking patterns and 5 steps for change. Are you your own worst enemy? Do you find yourself getting bogged down by negative thoughts that seem to take over your mind, no matter how optimistic your circumstances seem? Maybe you're constantly worrying about what ifs, or start feeling anxious about the possibility of something bad happening, even when there's no real reason for you to feel that way. If you're constantly defaulting to negative conclusions, you may be suffering from negative thinking patterns in your thought process. All of us have moments where we think the worst and jump to conclusions, even when logic might show us no evidence that something bad will happen. We can't help but think of only the worst. It's natural for our minds to search for the negatives. This likely dates back to primal times when humans had to be on high alert for wild animals and anticipate danger or threats. Our survival depended on it. Today, in modern society, we don't have to worry about our survival in the wild, but we often find ourselves overly stressed and anxious about life. If you've struggled with depression, stress, or anxiety, you understand how difficult it is to turn those negative thoughts into more positive ones. Aaron Beck, a U.S. psychiatrist, recognized that there are specific patterns to negative thinking. As he met with his patients and allowed them to talk freely about their depression and struggles, he began to see 10 different types of negative thinking emerge. These patterns are called cognitive distortions or distorted thinking. Dr. Beck saw that his patients focused on distortions that were faulty and misinformed, which led to overwhelmingly negative feelings and conceptions in their life. They are irrational thoughts and beliefs that we unknowingly reinforce over time. So he wondered if his patients could learn to recognize their thought distortions and challenge them in order to heal. As a result, he created a new therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT. His goal with this approach was to guide patients into changing deeply held negative beliefs about themselves and the world, manage their depression, anxiety, and mental health issues, and take back control of their lives. As we explore each distortion, notice if you find yourself defaulting to one or more of them. All or nothing thinking. This is seeing things in black and white with no shades of gray. If things aren't perfect, you see them as a failure. For example, you started a new diet and for the first few days, you're eating according to plan. And then you have a sliver of apple pie. You berate yourself for not being perfect and tell yourself, "I've blown it. I might as well eat the whole pie. I'm such a failure." Overgeneralization. One thing happens and you believe that it always happens to you. Or you want something to happen and when it doesn't, you believe it never happens to you. These thoughts are upsetting and set up a cycle of defeat. For example, you've asked someone out on a date and they say no. Your automatic response is, "I'll never find someone to go out with me." Mental filter. Of all the things going well, you pick one negative detail out and focus all your attention on it. For example, you received 20 feedback forms after facilitating a workshop. 19 of the forms were filled with positive statements about you and your work. One form noted that you could have managed your time better. All you thought about was that one negative statement while ignoring all the other positive feedback. Discounting the positive. You often feel inadequate or unappreciative because you ignore positive experiences. For example, you sang beautifully on stage, but told yourself it wasn't good enough. Jumping to conclusions. How often have you jumped to a conclusion based on a feeling or thought without any evidence to support it? Mind reading example. You seem to know exactly how someone is thinking. You often interpret an action or response and conclude that you're not liked or that someone is angry with you. Fortune telling example. You already know you're going to struggle with something before it is even started. Magnification, minimization. Your special magnifying glass can magnify any issue, making it bigger than it really is. Or you're able to minimize the situation and your positive qualities. For example, you agreed to pick up milk on the way home from work. With a lot of things on your mind, you forgot. In your mind, you became the most forgetful, unreliable, disorganized person there is. Emotional reasoning. This cognitive distortion allows you to believe that whatever you're feeling, it must be so. For example, you're anxious about driving, so you've concluded that driving is unsafe. Should statements. You have a clear idea about how things should or shouldn't be. When they don't turn out that way, you blame yourself and others. For example, "I should have done it my way instead of listening to you. It's your fault it didn't work out." Labeling. This distortion is like all or nothing thinking. You label yourself in a negative way when you've done something you or others don't like. You don't realize that you're not your behavior. And when someone else does something you don't like or makes a mistake, you label them, writing them off as their behavior. For example, you give someone directions that turn out to be wrong. Instead of recognizing you've made a mistake, you label yourself, "I'm such an idiot." Or you give someone else a label when they disappoint you or make a mistake. "They're such a liar." Personalization and blame. You hold yourself responsible for events or things you don't have 100% control over. This distortion involves the blame game. When you blame something or someone else, you don't have to look at your own part in the situation. For example, your child gets in trouble at school And instead of being curious about what happened and why, you blame yourself for being a terrible parent, or you blame others for your child's challenges at school. It's the teacher's fault that my child's in trouble. She's a terrible teacher. Our thoughts create our feelings. Changing our thoughts change how we feel. This simple yet challenging formula is what will turn these cognitive distortions around. Ready for some strategies? All right. Step one, identify your distortions. Keep a journal. As you become familiar with the 10 cognitive distortions, notice which ones you seem to favor. Write down your thoughts and any corresponding distortions to help you keep track of what you're thinking about and how you're feeling. Step two, challenge your thinking. It's important to challenge your thoughts because not all of your thoughts are true. As you write down your thoughts and the corresponding distortion, ask yourself, is this really true? Do I know this to be true for sure? Have I checked all the facts? Take a step back and assess the situation again. Continue challenging your thinking with other questions like, am I really a bad person? Or could it be that they were doing their best when they made the mistake? Or when would this not be true? Step three, compassionate self-talk. We are often extremely hard on ourselves. Our self-talk is harsh, negative, and sometimes abusive. When you think about how you would speak to a good friend, chances are you would never say the things you say to yourself to a friend. For each distortion you've identified, write down how you would respond to a good friend. Then practice using this more compassionate self-talk with yourself. Step four, seek support. Find a friend or someone you trust to help you challenge your assumptions and distortions. The right questions can help lift you and shift your perspective from black and white to shades of gray. Creating some flexibility in your thinking can help you lower your stress, feel less anxious, and shift away from depression. Step five, positive negative outcomes. Self-assessment is key to finding the mental and emotional freedom you're looking for as you challenge your own cognitive distortions. By asking yourself to assess the positive and negative outcomes of sticking with your perspective, you're able to decide whether it's worth keeping or changing it. Here are some questions that might help. How will it help me or hurt me if I believe this distortion? Will it move me closer to being the person I want to be or further away? If I dig my heels in and continue to believe this thought, how will it impact my relationships? How do I feel about myself? Does believing this distortion help or harm my depression, confidence, self-worth, or anxiety? Changing your mindset to impact hope and your future involves several key shifts in thinking and behavior. Don't forget to focus on the positive. Train yourself to see the silver lining in every situation, even in challenging times. There are lessons to be learned and opportunities for growth. Practice gratitude. Don't let it just be an embroidery on a pillow. Regularly take time to reflect on the things you're grateful for. This can help shift your focus from what you lack to what you have, fostering a sense of hope and abundance. When you're goal setting, set realistic goals. Remember, break down your long-term goals into smaller, achievable steps. Celebrate each milestone you reach, no matter how small. I'm not talking a party here, but give yourself some kudos. Embrace failure as a learning opportunity. Instead of seeing failure as a setback, view it as a stepping stone to success. Learn from your mistakes and use them to fuel your determination. Make sure you surround yourself with positive influences. You are who you spend your time with. Spend your time with people who uplift and inspire you. Their positivity can help reinforce your own hopeful outlook. Make visualization part of your practice. Take time to envision the future you want to have for yourself. Visualizing your goals can help you make them feel more attainable, and it will keep you motivated. Be kind to yourself and practice self-compassion, especially in times of difficulty. Treat yourself with the same compassion you would offer a friend facing a challenge. It's important to stay flexible because life is unpredictable and plans may need to change. So stay open to new opportunities and be willing to adapt your goals as circumstances evolve. And don't forget, seek support. Don't be afraid to reach out for help when you need it, whether it's from friends, family, or a professional. Having a support system can provide comfort and hope. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you. Your mindset shapes your outlook on life, influencing your sense of hope and belief in the future. Cultivating a positive mindset can fuel your determination and resilience, helping you overcome challenges with optimism. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you, how I wound up here.